This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Wrap up our discussion of race in the U.S. Army with Dr. Amanda Nagel. Dr. Nagel, welcome.
Thank you.
And we have talked pretty comprehensively about race in the military up until, well, the Army, up until World War I and kind of the period after. Now, the interwar years are fascinating when we look at them from a racial history perspective, because on one hand, you know, most Americans associate Jim Crow with, like, 1880, but in reality, you can argue it was the worst in the 1920s, particularly coming out of the Wilson era. But on the other hand, you start to see the very beginnings of the civil rights movement, particularly once we get to the 1930s. So we've talked extensively about what life was like for black soldiers before World War I. How is it any different, if at all, in the post-World War I period?
Right, so as World War I is winding down, and as soldiers are discharged, they went off to war with hope. And the way Chad Williams describes this in his recent book, A Wounded World, about W.E.B. Du Bois and the First World War, they come back disillusioned in a lot of ways, because the hope was that by doing what they did, by serving in the United States Army, by sacrificing their lives, their livelihood, potentially, for the war effort, it would show they are two American citizens, that they are deserving of full citizenship and all that entails. Mm-hmm. Right? But you have a combination of coming out of World War I, you've got a combination of nativism with racism, along with insecurity associated with unemployment, because one of the things that occurs in 1919, 1920 is now all of these GIs who had been in the war, they're now flooding the market.
Right, and of course, like after every war, the economy tanks.
Of course, right? And so there's competition there. You've also got, with World War I, the re-rise of the KKK. And so that's taking part in terms of how they're going to be received when they come home. Mm-hmm. So we have roughly 19 documented lynchings of African American soldiers or veterans in between December 1918 and January of 1920. And so their reception home is not exactly what they had envisioned outside of their own community.
Now. And as I understand it, too, I think we talked about this a little mm-hmm. bit. Many of them, for the first time, had experienced a society that, we're not going to exaggerate, but in Europe, a society that was less racist than America.
Well, at least less racist towards them.
Right.
Yes. They were treated as Americans, not necessarily as black.
Right. And the French army was happy to accept black soldiers.
Yes, absolutely. Because at that point, by 1917, 1918, the French army was hurting.
Yeah.
And they needed bodies. They needed extra units everywhere, right? And so they were more than happy to take the 93rd Provisional Division and integrate them in to their forces and have that happen. But we end up seeing in the aftermath of the war, people like Henry Johnson, who wins the Croix de Guerre, dying penniless in the 1930s from wounds that he took during the war. And that was fairly common. Now, one of the other things that we see too is that there's a push among scholars to try to write the definitive history of African Americans in the war, and that becomes a real problem mm-hmm. in trying to figure out how to deal with what happened in terms of the courts martial that occurred in the field in the fields in France, mm-hmm. what that meant for African American officers who were trained at Camp Des Moines, and all of that, right? So out of this, you end up actually seeing many become part of this growing civil rights movement, including Charles Hamilton Houston, who becomes a lawyer for the NAACP, mm-hmm. right? He's the one who will train Thurgood Marshall. Now, as we move into the 1920s, one of the really difficult documents that gets published when it comes to African American military service is an Army War College report about African Americans in combat arms, specifically in combat arms, mm-hmm. right? And the study is damning, to say the least. It's clearly that you can. It's open source, so if you Google this, you can actually find this report and read it. It is very clearly written with a perspective in mind. Yeah. It is not It's not one that is friendly to African American military service, and particularly service in combat. Mm-hmm. It falls on using a lot of those stereotypical tropes about intellectual capabilities, mental, moral capabilities, courageousness, all those, like it all that sort of stuff is in there, and it really kind of destroys any chance that any positive movement that seemed to be possible.
Yeah.
Right, with the creation of those camps and at least giving African American soldiers the opportunity, and particularly officers, the opportunity to lead.
Mm-hmm. So when you talked about the lynchings, mm-hmm. and these were veterans, not Aura
yes.
soldiers.
Yes, and right, there's at least one documented lynching of a soldier who was on furlough to deal with his father's estate. Yeah, his father's affairs.
And then so. As the U.S. Army demobilizes mm-hmm. from World War One, a lot of units, all units, white units, black units, are all going away. So by the 1920s, how many are we left with? Is because we got this War College report,
right?
Is it less than what we had before? Is it about? Is it the same?
It's a same proportion, if I'm remembering correctly. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but we still have the 9th and 10th Cavalry. We still have the 24th, 25th Infantry. Those don't go away, right? But those are regiments, not divisions. We still have National Guard participation in a variety of states. But the numbers shrink significantly because we see that full demobilization.
On the National right? Guard participation, that's and this is actually a fairly new thing, because mm-hmm. up until 1916, it had been state militia of various and sundry categories.
Right.
So are they also, I'm assuming they're also segregated state Guard, State National Guard as well?
Yes, they're so the 93rd Provisional Division came from National Guard regiments from various states. One was the 8th Illinois from Chicago, which actually, of the 93rd, they're one of the few that had a number of African-American officers already with, because that one's out of Chicago. Mm-hmm. They're the Chicago area. The 369th, the Harlem Hellfires, right? They were the 15th New York. Right, so you do have some of that, but it's with the National Guard, it's not as prominent, and it's going to be in certain areas of the country, and it's going to be in certain, essentially around certain cities.
So we're seeing with the impact of this War College report is we're not going to expand any African American regiments, but they're not getting rid of the ones they have.
They're not necessarily going to get rid of the ones they have, no, but they're also not going to encourage officers, mm-hmm. right? And that's the other thing, right? It's not until the 1930s when we get the next African-American cadet at West Point to enroll and be accepted as a cadet, Benjamin Davis Jr. The last African-American cadet was Charles Young, mm-hmm. who commissioned in 1886, I believe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So,
let's talk about this transition, because I think mm-hmm. it's an important one. I think you have very well detailed kind of the build-up through World War One and then the disappointment after. And now we're going to see a transition almost to a new generation mm-hmm. of civil rights campaigners. We're going to see people like Marcus Garvey mm-hmm. and W.B. Du Bois kind of not go away, but maybe transition out. Some of them are just going to die. I think Garvey dies fairly early in
yes.
there. And we also are going to start to see organizations like the NAACP and like others, particularly out of northern cities, begin to shine a harsher light in new media. We're not far from the advent of television and film, but still radio, on civil rights abuses as Jim Crow mm-hmm. really digs in, particularly in the South, but across the country. So how do we transition from this kind of capstone Army War College Report 1925, mm-hmm. basically everything before it mm-hmm. has been devalued, if not mm-hmm. entirely made pointless. How do we transition to this new generation that's going to take us into World War II?
Honestly, in part, it comes from things like the Harlem Renaissance. It's art, music, literature, etc. And in a lot of ways, it's a critique of everything going on around these artists in mm-hmm. in the world, right? You like Claude McKay, Langston Hughes, right? Like the mm-hmm. big names, they are all part of this movement, right? Langston Hughes, his I Too, right? Mm-hmm. I Too Speak America, right? Like that, yeah. that poem is very much rooted in a lot of how African Americans are feeling about what the
Raising
United States
the
actually means.
Well, right?
Absolutely, yeah. yeah.
It leads to the play much later. But
right.
That famous quote of what happens to a raisin in the sun.
Yeah, and you tie that into jazz and its proliferation and what music then becomes in terms of a protest. Mm-hmm. Not that it wasn't necessarily before, right? We have a long history of that among African Americans, but
it's now pop music.
Right. It's now more popular, and it's not just popular in the United States, it's spreading abroad, right? France is huge
right,
with
yeah.
this.
Well, and I know Hughes spent a lot of time like in the Caribbean yes. and South America trying to build the pan Africanism
right.
that Marcus Garvey did.
Right. And part of this ends up being expats.
Yeah.
There are going to be a number of African American veterans who will, after discharge, from the army, they'll head back to France because they will want to live there right. as opposed to stay in the United States.
As Josephine Baker does.
Absolutely, right? And so that then influences how they're thinking about the United States, but also about where they need to be or where mm-hmm. they should be. And so there's this almost renewed vigor to fight in some sense, but there's a cynicism to it in some cases when it comes to the Harlem Renaissance. And so that reinvigorates a lot of this into the 1930s and 40s. So then by the time we get to World War II, even with Du Bois, there's a no, we are not going to let this happen again. We are not going to let this fake promise of participation, of citizenship that we saw with World War I. If we serve for this second, we're not going to let this happen again.
Kind of the dream deferred.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
At the end of World War One, we had this case of veterans associations start to become more prominent and prevalent because there's just so many of them now, right? I'd have to go back and look and see when the Veterans of Foreign Wars and American Legion started, but there were organizations like them if those weren't there already. So the question then comes into, were African Americans present in these veteran organizations? Did they create their own? And what role did that play in all of this?
So frequently they had to create their own, particularly if certain cities had segregated the participation. However, we do see shifts with things like the Bonus Army,
mm-hmm.
right? The Bonus Army is essentially integrated. It is like across the board. It is soldiers, Marines, sailors, etc., from all walks of life, and they work together to try to force Congress to actually do something.
So for our listeners, the Bonus Army is this big mass protest. These World War One veterans mm-hmm. have been promised essentially an annuity for fighting. That wasn't due to be paid for, I think, till 1945.
45 is when it was due to be paid, yeah.
The Depression hits. Everything's really bad. A lot mm-hmm. of these veterans have not gotten good-paying jobs, so they kind of fall out of the economy. There's this big march on Washington in 32. Mm-hmm. Hoover wants nothing to do with it. He sends the army out, including some names people might recognize, like Douglas MacArthur and George
Losing
Patton.
Command.
Right. Patton, I believe,
and
Eisenhower.
There is a tension between yep. the active duty and the veterans. It's not the
yes.
community you might think. And so this Bonus Army becomes a big protest, really hurts Hoover at the ballot box in 32.
Mm-hmm. So with that, you said it's integrated. So mm-hmm. is this along the lines of, like, integrated, like there's the black veterans over here and the white veterans over here, or are they actually all
okay.
together?
Okay, it's a Hooverville, so everybody is mixed together, right? There's really no way to actually do that in a segregation. So, right, so Hooverville is a shanty town. So basically a homeless camp set up. The way they did it for the Bonus March was right across from Congress and at Anacostia Flats, right? Mm-hmm. 10,000 veterans and their families.
And this is prefiguring the civil rights things like the March on Washington much later.
Exactly. And this was a way to kind of try to force Congress to vote in favor of the Bonus Bill. Now, Congress votes against it, and that's then when Hoover will send in MacArthur and
what is commonly known as the Battle of the Anacostia Flats.
Yes.
So I want to ask you, Dr. Nance, a question about this, because one of the things we often assume is that there's a solidarity. In the case of racial groups, we assume mm-hmm. solidarity within the racial groups, but here we're talking about the military. So put yourself in the shoes of somebody like Douglas MacArthur, or even, you know, Junior Officer George Patton. And there's these homeless veterans who are demanding Congress do something to give them money, breaking the contract they signed to give them money early. What tensions might you see between the active duty force designed to clear them out and these veterans who are doing what they're doing?
This is getting at a larger tension in the U.S. military in general, which is the U.S. military really up until the all-volunteer force. And we've had an all-volunteer force, really. This is the 1970s was not the first time we'd had an all-volunteer force.
Right.
But the there was a definite distinction between the regulars, the guys that had that were long service professionals that were there to serve in time of peace and in war, and often in fairly rough living conditions, because Congress really didn't get serious about military living conditions and benefits. You can quibble over the date, but I would say the 1980s and the 1990s.
So these soldiers might not be living all that differently from the shantytown.
Right. Well, they've got three hots and a cot. But
that might be it.
They've got a roof over their head. They've got clothes. They've got chow. But they're not living. They're not necessarily living in luxurious conditions. And then you have the guys that sign up for the war. And there is some, hey, glad you're here. You know, we certainly appreciate you being there, but there's a definite tension between the rookie or slash citizen soldier mm-hmm. and the long service professional. And you see this, I mean, you can see it in the literature, you can see it in the public media, like movies, of the hard as nails, often portrayed as West Pointer, and the guy that's just out to get it done.
Yeah.
And depending on who's directing the movie, it depends on who comes out more more sympathetic.
Right.
But the idea basically being is there's a lot of regular soldiers that do feel sympathy for these guys. I mean, you can't not feel sympathetic for them, but by the same token, it's like, guys, you know, there's that frustration of, you know, you're a bunch of frickin' volunteers. You knew what the deal was. I knew what the deal was. And the other problem, of course, is where do you think that money's going to come from if they're going to allocate money to pay the bonus marchers off early.
Yeah, and bear in mind, this is pre-New Deal. The government is still mm-hmm. relatively small, so yeah. Yeah, and you bring up a good point, and I think it's relevant to all of this, that you know, just because people belong to a group doesn't mean they identify with the ideas or individuals of that group.
Yeah. So, quick question on that, and because this is something that I have brushed past any number of times, but never spent any amount of time with. Is there any sort of differentiation in the actual execution of the Battle of the Anacostia Flats? In other words, do the Black veterans come in for more casualties? Do we even know?
That's the thing, right? There are so many different reports about how many people were injured and or killed. Right,
anywhere from tens to thousands.
Exactly, right, and so it's difficult to determine just because it's so hard to even determine how if anyone actually died. Well, yes, there were casualties, but like,
and very few people want to talk about this incident in good faith.
Exactly. There's most people will really take one hard side one way or the other, and that's kind of how they'll look at. But yeah, it's really difficult to kind of parse some of that out, especially when they didn't necessarily have a whole lot of they weren't armed necessarily, not that I'm aware of anyway.
I'm sure that there was somebody that probably took up. They were not grabbing like rifles.
Oh no, right? But, like yelling. This isn't to say that they didn't pick up something along the way, but when I'm saying they weren't armed, I'm saying most of them probably didn't have a rifle or a gun of any kind necessarily. Because this was essentially intended as a protest. This wasn't intended as an armed anything.
Now, there's a story, I'm not quite sure if it's apocryphal or actual. It's hard to tell. But there's a point where Patton, who is commanding one of the cavalry formations, comes up and comes across a guy that was his orderly during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he allegedly tells the orderly, "Get away from me!" Now, there's two ways to take that, right?
Right.
One is he wants nothing to do with this guy, going about the antipathy we talked about before, mm-hmm. and you've chosen the wrong side. There's another more sympathetic way of looking at that, of he cares for the guy mm-hmm. and doesn't, and it's like, dude, you need to get out of here because some bad stuff's about to go down.
Yeah.
I don't know enough of the rest of the story to do that, but that's a case of that one small incident shows kind of the two-faced nature of this.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem, right? Is that it's trying to figure out what the motivations were, and especially in the midst of, like, there's a lot of myth that comes out with some of these sorts of things, and trying to figure out myth from fact is mm-hmm. especially with with the documentation that's available, it's difficult to do.
So with the button
The takeaway from all this, I think, is really important, that this is an integrated force mm-hmm. in a way that it's kind of puts to lie a lot of the things that War College Report said.
Oh, absolutely.
So we're now at 32, bonus march. Mm-hmm. We're now moving into the era of the New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
So we're setting aside the kind of laissez-faire Republicans of the 20s. We're moving mm-hmm. into these progressive Democrats, and truly progressive, not mm-hmm. Wilsonian progressive. And Roosevelt is implementing all of these new Deal programs. We're going to rebuild the country. We're going to mm-hmm. pull ourselves out of the Depression. Mm-hmm. We're going to put everybody back to work. Okay, how does civil rights play in that?
Well, at least for Roosevelt, it was not quite an afterthought, but...
For Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah. Yeah, well... No, that's the one I'm talking about. I'm not talking about Teddy.
Well, there's another Roosevelt I'm sure we'll get to at some point.
Right, Eleanor. Right, yeah. Eleanor, yes. For FDR, his emphasis essentially was on was to make sure that white Americans could get back to work before anybody else. Now, as you mentioned, his wife had Eleanor had completely different views on this,
mm-hmm.
and that basically kind of argued to FDR, you can't leave them behind. You can't do that. But what ends up happening, right, is that so with things like the AAA, the agriculture, exactly, right? It's alphabet soup.
Yep.
That is always how I used to teach
that's how
to
I
students.
Teach it too,
right, yeah, it's just alphabet soup.
The Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yep. Right, the Civilian Conservation Corps,
The Works Progress Administration.
Right, the Works Progress Administration, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the pick your thing. It's just a bunch of letters combined. But yeah, so for the Agricultural Adjustment Act, right? One of the things that it did was pay money to landowners if their crops were dying or if they couldn't actually make a yield for the year. The problem for that, of course, is it went to the person who owned the land, not to the person who farmed the land.
The sharecropper makes a profit off the crop if there's no crop.
Right. And so what we end up getting is a large number of sharecroppers getting kicked off of their lands. They start migrating west, right?
And not just black sharecroppers, the Okies from Steinbeck,
absolutely,
who are largely white.
Yes. So yeah, tenant farmers are also getting, this is affecting all poor Southerners, right? White and black. And so many of them start migrating west. Some of them will go to Oklahoma, right, the Okies, and then they will continue on to places like California looking for jobs.
Right.
But some of what we end up seeing is good that comes out of this in terms of like the Works Progress Administration, right? The WPA slave narratives, right? Academics essentially hired to do stuff.
Yeah.
Because academics have to eat too. I mean,
we can appreciate that.
Right. Yep. Right. Exactly. and so we get documentation out of this because of things like that. But yeah, for the most part, it's African Americans are going to be. Not fully, but at least a decent chunk are left behind by some of these. So you actually see a rise in membership in the Communist Party during the 1930s as a result of all the frustration over economic unemployment and all that.
Which makes sense because it's about solidarity.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So Dr. Nance, real quick, if you could give us a very quick overview of what the military's role was in the New Deal.
Okay. So what the military is doing during this time frame is they are providing a lot of the administration and kind of command and control behind this, which the Army is not overly thrilled with doing. Because what they're doing is that now it's not, like for instance, Civilian Conservation Corps. They are the Army is often providing the basic infrastructure behind the camps, the logistics, all that kind of stuff. But it's frustrating for them because you don't even have military discipline a lot of the time. Whereas before, you could bring them in and go, well, you signed on the dotted line or you were drafted. Right. Now, they're having to run through this. Now, as an interesting aside, you can have your opinions on the Civilian Conservation Corps, but what was good for the Army is it gave them a rep at inducting large numbers of people into organizations that looked an awful lot like Army organizations.
Oh, and add that the CCC employees, they all had to be 18 to 25 and unmarried.
Exactly.
Right?
but bring all these people in, induct them, outfit them, feed them, train them, and then put them to effective use, which would prove to be useful in about 10 years.
Yes. Okay, so the Army's heavily involved in this, particularly on the manpower infrastructure side. I want to talk about the two Roosevelts and their attitudes, because I think they're important. You've talked about how kind of there's this building sense in culture and in advocacy of need to change. But the Roosevelts are plutocrats. They're kind of representative of very wealthy white establishment people. Franklin from the Hyde Park branch, Eleanor from the Oyster Bay branch. And yet they have opposing views on civil rights. So Franklin's, I think we can understand. I think he just doesn't care. I don't think he's like Wilson, where he's actively hostile to civil rights. Is that fair to say?
I would say so. That he's not necessarily overly.
Is he going out of his way?
He's not. It's not like Wilson, who's going to screen Birth of a Nation
right,
in the White House,
and
also resegregate the federal employment in 1915, right?
So FDR is. We can kind of understand where a New York plutocrat would arrive at that, but Eleanor is also a New York plutocrat. Would you describe her as being typical of kind of an activist person from her station, or was she unique?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know which one I'd describe her as, but what. But I guess how I would describe her is just kind of a force of nature, mm-hmm. in some ways. That she set her mind to things, and she made sure that they would get done. And so her voice behind FDR when it came to once World War II starts, it's significant in terms of pushing him. Mm-hmm. And essentially pushing this envelope, yeah. to say you can't do these things in this way anymore. You can't do that while we're at war.
Yeah.
Right. And especially while we're at war.
Which is a voice not only Wilson lacked, but a voice Wilson wouldn't even have listened to.
Yeah.
Now, before we get too much into the war, I did want to ask one question on that, mm-hmm. though, because I would like to get the war, World War II guy. But. As we talk about the Civilian Conservation Corps, one of the real benefits of it is that it actually teaches good trade skills.
Yeah.
Learn how to drive a truck, learn how to operate heavy machinery, all these kind of things. So, and then also with that, one of the things that I am not as familiar with is, were the African American units a part of the administration of the Civilian Conservation Corps? What were they doing in kind of the 30s? And then were African Americans being left out of the Civilian Conservation Corps to the point where they were losing out on these job training opportunities? So
right.
It's kind of two questions.
So one of the things that we see is that there are so few African American regiments, right? And at least in one case, the 10th Cavalry actually did not take part in those sorts of things. They were here at Fort Leavenworth. This is where they were stationed. And so then this actually hits some of the budgeting issues that you were talking about earlier in terms of, hey, where is this pot of money going to come from? One of the problems with deciding to follow through on Wilson's segregate federal employment also meant segregate the army, including at bases. And that meant trying to figure out how to provide equal opportunity, but also equal facilities for people. And that was very difficult in a budget-constrained time, especially with the Depression.
Yeah, nobody wants to fund the military, even once the New Deal kicks off, because there's only so much money. We're not fighting a war. Why should we?
Right. And so at least here at Fort Leavenworth, some of the issues include access to like physical facilities, right? So like the swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
White families essentially pushed hard enough on the commanding officers here to say, no, absolutely not. Despite the fact that we can't build another pool here, you are not going to let them use the pool because...
Mm-hmm. Which is a weird, weird racist panic in American history, the swimming pool thing.
Oh, it's... Yeah, there's a lot of weird
yes.
like, there's a lot of weird things like that. But one of those things was, right, of course, tied to the swimming pool. So, things like that. Another thing was the post theater. Only had one set of bathrooms, right? Refused to integrate those bathrooms, actually forced patrons, African-American patrons, to walk about half a mile away to use facilities.
And that's the post theater that's still here, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that makes
sense. Same one.
Yeah. It's an old building, and you can tell what you're talking about if you've been in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Now you add in that it's the 10th Cavalry, right? These are the Buffalo Soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
They are, right, stuff of legend. We have a monument to them outside, just not very far from this building.
Yep.
Right? Their job here, writing classes for the white children of... other soldiers stationed here, and or service jobs.
Yeah.
Specifically cleaning.
Yeah.
Trash, you name it, right? Like that's facilities jobs. That's what they were tasked with.
So there's something unique about Kansas City during this period, and it's the Pendergast machine. So there's the political machine run by the Pendergast. Eventually Teddy is kind of the main one. And Teddy cared more about making money than he did about racism.
Oh, absolutely.
So the city was one of the more integrated cities and cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Did that extend to the to Fort Leavenworth, or was Fort Leavenworth too far away?
I think Fort Leavenworth was too far away. But a lot of what ends up happening, though, is that soldiers, when they would retire out of Fort Leavenworth...
Moved to 18th and Vine.
They would absolutely move to 18th and Vine. So one of the benefits of there being an archive down there is
right.
that there's a plethora of information in their archive about this time period
yeah.
and about these soldiers, because they retired locally. So where are they going to donate any of their papers, or are they going to donate any of that information?
Yeah, so grad students,
18th and Vine.
So we've. It sounds like that not much has changed, even as we move through the New Deal era.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk about how we mobilized for World War II, because
mm-hmm.
that's going to change things.
Yes.
So the military scales very fast once Congress starts appropriating money,
mm-hmm.
late 1930s, 38, 39, 40. And at that point, as you said with Eleanor,
mm-hmm.
both philosophically and practically,
mm-hmm.
you simply cannot maintain the service job only,
mm-hmm.
fully segregated
mm-hmm.
military. So how does this play out?
Well, so in part, it skyrockets, of course, after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Right? That's going to be a huge part of it, is that yes,
we had the peacetime draft in 1940. Mm-hmm. Were African American soldiers included in that?
Yeah, so I think I'd have to look back at the dates to verify. I think James G. Thompson was drafted prior to or right around Pearl Harbor. I don't remember the exact date, but he is the man who, from Wichita, Kansas, who wrote into the Pittsburgh Courier and will eventually dub what the civil rights movement during the World War II era as the Double V campaign.
Well, because during the first part of the mobilization, it's the first part is just getting the units, the existing units, mobilized, federalized, and seeing what we've got. And it's
right.
not pretty.
No.
If I remember correctly, the numbers, basically you're going from 150,000 to 1.5 million, and then it's after Pearl Harbor that you go really,
really
fast,
big.
Much
yes.
bigger.
And this is where I was curious
yeah.
about, because as we start to mobilize, particularly as we start to create new formations,
mm-hmm.
and this is an interesting challenge. How do you create a brand new formation? And if you and the normal answer in the U.S. Army is you create a cadre. You have the option of creating an entirely brand new unit, but that gets very awkward when you start talking about the commanding officer, all the senior NCOs. This is not a case of, pack 100 dudes into a room, give them rifles, and call them a company.
It's also not the same as standing up a franchise of a company, because if you don't get it right, a lot of people will die.
Right. So what the Army does is it creates a cadre system,
mm-hmm.
where what it does is it slices off a percentage, kind of, and it's a salami slice. And what we mean
mm-hmm.
by that is all the way from senior folks all the way down to relatively junior folks.
So we might take the 4th Battalion of a regiment and make a new regiment out of it.
Right. And the battalion commander becomes basically the regimental commander or something similar to that. And then that one battalion
mm-hmm.
is then spread out to form the cadre to then new draftees will come into. So, of course, the bigger of a cadre you provide, the faster you can come up with, but you come up with fewer units. The smaller cadre, obviously longer. So, obviously, the coin of the realm here is trained soldiers. With that said, we have at least 4 regiments of trained
mm-hmm.
combat arms, 2 infantry, 2 cavalry, if not more,
right.
African-American soldiers. What role do they play in this?
Right, but that's the thing. Remember, it's the same thing with World War I, is that almost immediately it's going to be, as they bring in African Americans, and this will also include other groups of people too, right? It's trying to figure out what to do with Japanese Americans.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to figure out what to do with Hispanic or Latin Americans, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to figure out what to do with Native Americans. Like,
mm-hmm.
how are they going to be integrated in? Are they going to be separated out? And with that, as you're building this army, what is that going to look like? Where are you going to send them? Are they going to be, say, like our Japanese Americans say, going to be trusted to be sent to the Pacific, mm-hmm. right? And instead we send them to Europe. You see what I mean?
Well, as a, for instance, like in the United States Army, there was the 1st Cavalry Division, which was the active cavalry division.
Right.
You then had a 2nd Cavalry Division, which was at the time our divisions consisted of two brigades. One of the brigades in the 2nd Cavalry Division mm-hmm. was comprised of the 9th and 10th Cavalry Regiments. Now, the rest of the division was comprised of other existing units. I'd have to go back and look and see who they were. But I believe the 2nd Brigade or the other brigade were white cavalry regiments.
Right.
Or National Guard regiments that would come in later. I'd have to go back and look and see the difference. Yeah. However, it's a division on the books.
Right.
We mobilize the 2nd Cavalry Division, and almost immediately once it is formed, it is then immediately disbanded. This is why when we talk about the 90 Division gamble, it's really the 89 Division gamble, and the 2nd Cavalry Division was actually activated twice. So this is something that is worthwhile kind of for us to take a look at here. So what are they doing with these guys?
Well, so part of what ends up happening is as we start seeing this expansion, it's honestly, it's trying to figure out how to fill in other roles, right? It's not necessarily thinking about even 9th or 10th Cavalry or 24th and 25th Infantry Regiments being combat arms. It's that just because they are currently combat arms doesn't necessarily mean they're going to continue to be combat arms. Now, that's not to say that we don't have combat arms. We don't have regiments and even brigades of combat arms at this time. However, it's in the expansion, where do we put the effort? Where do we place these bodies? And it then becomes a fallback to the 1925 report and World War I that we're going to put them in support roles. They're going to be in labor battalions. They're going to be in engineering battalions. They're going to be in transportation. They're going to be in all of these other things that aren't necessarily combat arms.
So I think a story that will illustrate all of these issues really well is something that was actually in the news not too long ago, and it's the 1945 dock explosion in California.
Mm.
So if you mm-hmm. could tell us a little bit of the story of that, and in particular, why it happened, I think that will show us what black, in this case, sailors faced.
Right. So with that explosion, if I'm remembering correctly, because there were a number of explosions and all sorts of things that that occurred during industrial expansion, shall mm-hmm. we say, during World War II. If I'm remembering that one correctly, the rate of production and the rate of essentially specifically loading munitions onto ships, the demand for how fast it needed to go was really high
mm-hmm.
in order to get them out, right? And so in this case, when one of the rounds exploded, I believe it killed approximately 250 to 300, maybe, mm-hmm. if I'm remembering the numbers correctly. Most of them African Americans, either workers or sailors.
Right.
Right. And in the end, their lives didn't necessarily fully matter.
And then you have this follow-on where there's a huge, like, 88 court-martials?
Yes, because they're going to refuse to actually continue working in unsafe conditions. Therefore, because they are under the War Department, they are subject to the earliest days of UCMJ and all of that.
So why were the conditions unsafe? I mean, you know, you can speak to this retired Colonel Nance. You know, there are ways to handle ammunition. So
yes.
What was the problem here?
In part, it's because of the speed at which they were being asked to do this, right? They were being asked to do it too fast to then be able to load the munitions safely onto these vessels. That was part of the problem. And with that, you add in that essentially with the War Production Board, all of the different pieces of legislation and the new organizations that are created by FDR as the U.S. mobilizes, one of the problems is that they're going to want to run these 24/7.
Right.
They don't want a break. They want everything to go fast, like as fast as possible. Get it done, get it done, get it done. Because in some ways, honestly, they thought, especially for California, if they're sending any of these vessels to the Pacific, they're going to be at the bottom of the ocean within a couple of months. Right. So they didn't necessarily... They weren't really constructed to last,
well,
to put it mildly.
Ships, yeah.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And this is also one of the things we were, is that this was not like, oh, they didn't value the lives of the workers necessarily in terms of that. This is much more along the lines of all throughout World War II, they are doing things that today we would, as a society, cringe at.
Oh, absolutely.
And this goes from working conditions to tolerating just everything, under the sun. In term, like, no kidding, in Salerno, in Italy, they have a massive... typhoid outbreak, and typhoid is carried by fleas and lice. So they were stopping people at checkpoints and dousing them with DDT, dusting them with DDT,
which does kill pests,
and then letting them go along their way. Now we look at that and we shudder because how many cancer cases came from that?
One of the things I think that's really pernicious about the 45 incident and the defense that was used by the sailors was that they had never actually been trained on what it was they were doing.
Right.
And this is a problem across the armed forces, but it's also a specific problem with troops who are not white. And we've been talking a lot about black troops, but it's true across the board. Yeah, so I think what you end up seeing in World War II is practicality wins out in some cases, but not always in ways that are good.
Right. And when it comes to incidents like that, like as I mentioned, that's not the only one.
Right.
That's just one of the incidents. I mean, and especially when we're talking about full mobilization of the population, this is why Eleanor Roosevelt was so important to this, because she insisted that there not be barriers to employment or even positions within the armed forces, right? So she's going to be a big proponent of the Tuskegee Airmen, right? But in this case, what we see with this mobilization is that it opens up, and for the first time, it opens up a lot of employment to African Americans that they've never had the opportunity for.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking on the home front, too.
On the home front as well, yeah, exactly. So it's not just the home front, but we're seeing the ability to earn a paycheck that is equal to those around them, again, for the first time.
And right? Especially for black women.
Right. And black women are going to become a part of the workforce, too. Like,
never forget the original Rosie the Riveter photograph was a black woman.
No, absolutely. And one of the things that Eleanor Roosevelt does is create a propaganda film that actually does include many different groups of people, specifically women, at war, and that's kind of the way she kind of promotes is that women are helping the effort too, and she makes a point to make sure that that this propaganda film includes white and black women who are working in these factories, and so it's basically kind of saying everybody's doing their part, you should do your part too. But again, like when some of this employment is opened for the first time, it's the opportunity to do so. I mean, even African American women will join the armed forces as well, right? We got the 6888, who will be responsible for mail delivery, and they take that they took that job very seriously.
Yeah, there's a movie
overseas.
Coming out about that.
Yes, there is. I have spoken, hearing one of my colleagues who researches this, she's Not sure how the film will depict.
Yeah. Well, we can be cautiously optimistic, right?
Right, right.
Yeah,
right.
And I want to touch on something you study, Dr. Nance, mm-hmm. Because there's an infamous incident that takes place around race and soldiers of color during the Battle of the Bulge, mm-hmm. where there's this German group of Nazis. They're running around behind Allied lines. They run across a group of black soldiers. I think they're service troops. And they massacre them because they're black.
It's the Verenbacht 11 or something like that. Yeah. I'm screwing up the name, but it's close.
So the question I have is, okay, yes, we have a group of Nazis massacring a bunch of American troops. How did the army react to that from your perspective as kind of an operational researcher? Did they care that they were black, or did they care that they were Americans?
A little from column A, a little from column B. I haven't seen a lot of direct... Mm-hmm. discussion about that, to be honest. However, this is also going on at the same time as the Malmedy/Bugnez massacre. It's not a shock that the Nazis are killing prisoners. People are upset and angry about it, but I haven't seen anything where the Malmedy massacre gets it gets a lot more attention than this other massacre. Mm-hmm. You can argue that it was because they were black, or because they were service troops, or because it was yet another. It was 11 I think it was like 11 soldiers. It's 11 soldiers in a campaign when literally tens of thousands of casualties are happening.
Well, and this is also right. This is also one where Nazi soldiers are going to take prisoners at the Battle of the Bulge, and what they will do is start going through and looking for Jewish American soldiers and anyone who to them does not seem white. And so we'll actually have a number of American soldiers captured at the Battle of the Bulge, including Hispanic American, Mexican American soldiers from like California, taken prisoner and sent to concentration camps. But we don't, of course, know that until the 1990s, I think, was when that was finally declassified.
Now, what's fascinating about the Battle of the Bulge, too, is that we start running out of infantry replacements. We are dramatically short. During the Battle of the Bulge, what we're doing is we are combing through all of our formations. Like, we realize we don't need as many air defense units. So, like, I don't care that you were running a quad 50, shooting down nothing. You are now an infantryman.
If only we had a bunch of service troops with combat.
And that is
And
what it is this is a big. This is actually a big dramatic moment with the senior command, where they sit there and go, what we're going to do is they go to the service troops, like, who'd like to be a rifleman?
Right.
And they get lots of volunteers.
They get more volunteers than they expected to get. Because that's the thing, right, is that for men who are part of things like the Red Ball Express, all they want to do is to get into combat, because it comes back to... this is how we show that we are citizens. We've got to do these things.
To put to lie that Army War College report.
Exactly. And, but part of it, too, is it comes back to the Double V campaign. It's victory at home and victory abroad, right? Over racism and Nazism, basically, right? Like, that's what this is victory at home and victory abroad. How can you fight for this victory if you can't fight for this victory, right?
Right.
But granted, like, don't get me wrong, like, they did a fantastic job with the Red Ball Express, getting everything going, making sure that the transportation of goods, ammunition, food, etc., can get to the front lines when necessary. But when asked, way more than expected volunteer to join infantry units. And so we actually do see some of the first combat integrated units in 1945 because of this.
And it's worth pointing out, in late World War II, this was essentially volunteering to be wounded or killed.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, most infantry units, given a span, most infantry companies, if you 30-40-day period, you were going to take anywhere from 50 to 100% casualties something.
Yeah. Didn't 4th ID take like 250% casualties?
Right, and then what makes it worse is that if you look at a division of, say, 12 to 15,000 soldiers, it's heavily concentrated in your infantry soldiers. Not to say that our artillery guys are getting wounded less because they're behind the lines. Guys in the headquarters. Yeah.
cooks, quartermasters. Yeah. It's the infantrymen that are right. that are getting cut down, right. hurt, and then oftentimes they'll come back. A guy will get hit two or three times.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, so one of the problems, though, too, is with documentation of some of this stuff, right? So one of the things that we see with World War II and propaganda is the emphasis on specifically the white soldier, yeah. right? Pictures of, photographs of, like, making sure that they are part of the story. Yep. But when it comes to African-American units, and this was true for World War I, too, there were very few pictures of World War I. There are going to be more pictures in World War II, but it's not going to make it home in terms of the film used, in terms of the shots that are taken, because they're going to sell the American public a very sanitized version of African-American military service.
There's a great period clip that I've used in class from time to time, talking about the Red Ball Express. Mm-hmm. And the Red Ball Express, and what's funny is that even some of the images show African-American soldiers.
Right.
Some, not many.
Right.
But the narrator is a New York cabbie. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And it is, but when you actually go back and look at the numbers,
right,
very heavily.
Yeah, 75% of the Red Ball Express were African-American soldiers.
And if people are interested in this, this documentary is on YouTube. It was made by the U.S. Army Signal Corps after World War II on the Red Ball Express. And yeah, you'd be hard-pressed from it to know that 75% of the drivers were black.
Right. And that's in part...
And that's after the war.
Right. And that's in part, it's because of how it's documented. Even a film. I think there was I believe Sidney Poitier was in it. He was one of the only African Americans in this film about the Red Ball Express, right?
Right.
But that's the thing, is that when it comes to the propaganda and the way that the War Department viewed how to depict... strength, courage, capability in combat, it was very, very particular. So in one case, Joe Louis, right, the boxer, right, famous boxer, right, he was depicted doing training for combat, but not like in a potential combat position,
but it's
Joe Louis, or you want to see him like that, but at the same time you need to see him like white Americans needed to see him as a non-threatening in terms of physical attack on someone, right? And so you see similar sorts of things in terms of how Dory Miller was treated in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor and the reporting that went on. It actually took until the Pittsburgh Courier found his mother to then be able to splash his face on the cover of a newspaper, because the War Department refused, and specifically the Department of the Navy, refused to identify him as the mess man who was a hero of Pearl Harbor.
So if we're talking African Americans in World War II, we can't leave out the Italian theater and our good friend General Almond and 91st Division?
92nd Division.
Yeah.
Our good friend. Yeah. That's a way to put it.
Yeah.
Dr. Nance, that's a way to put it. Ooh, yeah.
So could you talk just a little bit about, because we've been saying most African Americans are relegated to service units. Could you kind of talk us through how the 92nd comes about and all that kind of stuff?
So, well, because the 92nd is that legacy from World War I, right? We got the 92nd, 93rd Division of World War I, so you're going to create those divisions again. General Allman served with them in World War I as well. So he had a particular view about African American soldiers' capabilities in combat. And he brought that with him to World War II, and oh, spoiler alert, he brings that with him to Korea as well. so he is going to be harsher as a general officer. He is going to be more difficult to work with and work under. It's not great. About probably the best way I can describe it.
But how does that translate into the division's combat performance then?
So, well, that's the thing, right, is he's essentially kind of in part self-sabotaging, right?
Is he trying to prove the War College Report?
Good question. I don't know for sure. I have suspicions, But he does not see the usefulness or capabilities of African American soldiers. He sees them as useless. He sees integration as a distractor, that it is not something that is worthwhile doing. I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, he's also from Alabama. So that kind of already set him in terms of how he was going to view this in World War One. Mm-hmm. Then with World War One and the high number of courts-martial that occurred during the First World War in France, specifically with the 92nd Division, it colors how he's going to look at this with World War II and how he'll approach it.
Now, as a side note, I had to actually look this up. I think it's the 93rd Division, its sister division.
Yes.
Is sent to the Pacific.
Yeah.
And never fights as a division. It is it is garrison it and is, service
yes.
Formations throughout the throughout several kind of rear echelon Pacific. Mm-hmm.
So let's go ahead and put a bow on this because, as you point out, there are many of the same problems in World War II as there are in World War One, despite having the Harlem Renaissance, the black press, black troops in combat. Mm-hmm. And yet, the Double V campaign works.
Yeah.
So what's kind of the takeaway from this? What happens going forward?
All right. So essentially, it's in part because many of these enlisted and officers who join for the Second World War refuse to give in. So you actually have a number of protests in uniform, sometimes on military bases, sometimes actually it's public transportation in the areas nearby, sometimes it's even on army transportation, because army transportation was contracted out of the local transportation, right? So there's actually an incident in Virginia where you've got some white soldiers who will also help African-American soldiers protest segregated buses, despite the fact, and specifically because the War Department will actually have to say at a certain, I can't remember what year it is, it's late in the war, it's like 43-44, but they basically finally say, we can't segregate transportation for our soldiers any longer, right? Bus drivers, particularly in southern states, are going to refuse to do this.
Right.
Therefore, you actually have white soldiers who are going to stand next to and stand up for African-American soldiers and essentially try to force these local bus drivers abide by Army policy,
right?
And this includes people like Jackie Robinson, who will get court-martialed for challenging this in Texas. Right now, he is one of the lucky ones who in his court-martial, he ends up getting cleared. But that is not necessarily the case across the board, but that's what essentially those are the sorts of things that we're seeing, is that soldiers are refusing to accept what happened with World War One ever again.
Right.
They're refusing to do so, and actually, in part, it comes from those veterans from World War One who took part in civil rights, who supported the NAACP, who supported all these other organizations that start popping up in northern cities, who took part in all of this sort of activism. That's then a new generation that we see with World War II also doing the same sort of activism to push back against these sorts of things, right? And it leads us to kind of understanding how they are it's essentially a refusal to not win this Double V campaign, right? It's a refusal to go back to how it was before, right? And so for many of them, just like with World War One, the uniform means something. The fact that they wore that uniform, the fact that they potentially could have died for the United States means something, not just to them, but to their communities and to the United States as a whole, right? And so when people like Sergeant Woodard come home from the Pacific, manage to survive, and he musters out of, I think he's discharged out of, is it Fort Gordon? I can't remember. Anyway, one of the southern bases, pick your southern base. On his way home, he ends up getting physically attacked by local police to the point that he's blinded, right? That was just literally, he's discharged. He's on his way home. He's heading home to New York.
Yeah.
And he is now, he becomes permanently blinded because the bus driver thought he was being insolent by asking to wait until he could use the restroom before continuing on the drive. I believe this was in South Carolina. The bus driver radioed ahead to police in the next town. They dragged him off and beat him in the county jail to the point of blinding him. Yeah.
Yeah, and out of these kinds of tragedies came the great era of civil rights. You mentioned Jackie Robinson, of course, headed for at least the legal integration of the government.
Medgar Evers was a veteran. James Meredith is a veteran of Korea. Right? Mm-hmm. Many, many African-American veterans are going to continue their civil rights activism out of uniform. Mm-hmm. They're going to join many of these organizations that pop up during the 1950s and 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they pulled some hope out of what was a bad situation for many. Mm-hmm. All right, Dr. Nagel, it's been an interesting discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.